Good afternoon. If that's when you're listening, I never know when you're listening. Welcome to The Scramble. Once again, just a review for you people on Mondays. Typically, if we can, we come back from the weekend with a show that's based on news that broke over the weekend or that allows us to update things, including, of course, the insane presidential campaign we are involved in. That will be the subject later on in the show. We have a guest coming in the second segment for that. And then in the third segment, and bear this in mind, if you're listening here in the afternoon, we'll be taking phone calls. 860-275-7266. Don't call now. We're not taking phone calls yet. But for the final segment of the show, I do want to open up the phone lines and talk to you, in particular about some of the themes that are emerging in this campaign. I think in particular, one of the things that I'm interested in as Donald Trump kind of lurches into this King Lear section of his campaign, he seems to be laying the groundwork for some thoughts about the illegitimacy of some presumed outcome because the election was rigged in some ways, that there were deficiencies at the polls because the media was against him because of this, because of that. And that ultimately also, if you listen to the rhetoric that he uses in characterizing his opponent, Hillary Clinton, and, I mean, you know, the caveat here is that politics is never, as they say, beanbag, but the constant refrain of crooked Hillary and the suggestion that she herself is not really a legitimate candidate. So where does that leave us? Imagine that he loses. Where are we as we head into 2017? What kind of alienation from the results of the election could we expect from the public? I want to talk to you about that a little bit, as well as other things that may have crossed your mind about that. But we're not beginning there. We're beginning in Wisconsin, where, in fact, several news stories of interest have been taking place over the weekend. The first is the overturning of the conviction of a young man who many people encountered in the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer, which is the story of a defendant named Stephen Avery and a victim named Teresa Halbach in a murder case. Avery often gets called the Stephen Avery case because he was found guilty of this murder, and he'd already had an imprisonment that had also been overturned, and it was suing some of the officials connected to that imprisonment. There was sort of a working hypothesis advanced in this Netflix documentary that maybe some of those people who were being sued, or at least agents of people being sued, public officials and law enforcement officials being sued, had an interest in seeing him convicted of this other case, of this other murder. And a kind of piece of collateral damage to all that was a young man named Brendan Dassey. He was about 17 years old at the time of the case. He confessed in a way that anybody who has watched the confession, and we'll play it for you in just a second, could not be entirely comfortable with. To say that he received ineffective assistance of counsel, it would be an understatement. Anyway, his conviction has been overturned. We're going to tell you a little bit more about that. And then we'll also talk about what's happening in Milwaukee right now. I'm sure everybody followed the unrest, the riots, really, in Milwaukee following a police shooting. So to join us and to help us do all that is Tom Kircher. He is PolitiFact Wisconsin reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he covered the Stephen Avery case for the Journal Sentinel. And those of you who watched the Netflix documentary may even remember seeing him. He does appear in that documentary. So first of all, welcome to our show, Tom.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
So maybe let's begin with the Brendan Dassey case. So he's the nephew of Stephen Avery, the principal defendant in this case. A higher court has overturned his conviction. They didn't say he was innocent, right? They said that there was a defect in that infamous confession.
Right. This wasn't a higher court in the sense of an appeal. This was a different sort of tack. He was prosecuted in state court. But the federal appeal he made is called a habeas petition, and it argued that his constitutional rights were violated because of the way he was interrogated. And what the federal judge in Milwaukee ruled on Friday, again, had nothing to do with whether Dassey is guilty or not guilty of the crime, but the judge found that, in fact, his constitutional rights were violated because of the way he was interrogated, made his confession involuntary.
We should say a little bit more about who he is. A very young man at the time, and a man who has, I think, what they sometimes call borderline intellectual deficiencies, right? A guy who maybe may not have been fully equipped to participate, at least fully, in his own defense.
Yeah, I think unsophisticated is a fair word. He was 16 years old. He mostly took general education classes in high school, but he also took some special ed classes. Had no prior criminal history, and so, you know, it was very new certainly to the process of being questioned by some veteran investigators.
We're going to hear just a little bit of that questioning. You're going to hear these investigators trying to get Brendan Nassy to talk about what he and his uncle, Stephen Avery, had done to Teresa Halbach's head.
Come on. Something with the head. Brendan?
Yeah.
What the hell did you guys do? Come on.
What he made you do, Brendan, we know he made you do something else.
What was it? What was it?
We have the evidence, Brendan. We just need you to be honest with us.
Did he cut off her hair?
He cut off her hair. Okay, what else?
What else was done to her head?
That he punched her.
What else?
Extremely, extremely important you tell us this. For us to believe you. We know, we just need you to tell us.
That's all I can remember.
All right, I'm just gonna come out and ask you. Who shot her in the head?
He did.
Why didn't you tell us that?
Because I couldn't think of it.
So, Tom Kircher, one of the things that's at issue here is they seem to initially try to withhold a piece of information to see whether Brendan Dassey has it, whether he knows it or not. It's a really basic piece of information about the fact that she was shot in the head, and eventually they supply it to him. Was that part of the thing that the—I don't know how specific U.S. Magistrate Judge William E. Duffin was in saying that the confession was unconstitutional and coerced.
Yeah, he did say that it was sort of the totality of the different interrogations, the times like the one you just played where it appeared that the investigators were feeding facts to Dassey, so to speak, or in other cases suggesting to him that if he just told the truth, he would be fine. The judge made it clear that it was not any one question or one session, but the entirety of the interrogations.
So what happens now is that they have, I guess, 90 days to either release him or start retrial proceedings. Do you have a sense of how this is likely to play out over the next 90 days?
We don't have a strong sense yet. You know, it was a 91-page ruling. It was issued Friday afternoon. You know, I think it's fair to say the attorneys on both sides for Brendan and for the state, you know, would want to review it closely before making a decision. Before the decision came out, though, I had spoken to a number of attorneys familiar with the case. Their best guess was that whichever way the federal judge ruled, they would expect one side or the other to appeal, and that ultimately a decision would come from the federal appeals court in Chicago some months or more down the line, but too early to say right now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting moves that might be made under those circumstances, either while waiting for an appeal or if the state is considering a retrial, is if he has effective counsel this time, which I presume he now does, I mean, it might make sense for him to get out on bail too. I mean, I don't know if that's been discussed or not, but it seems that now, having had his conviction overturned because of a faulty confession, he'd have a better argument for a release on bail.
There is that possibility. That's right.
So we don't know whether the state's going to retry. Probably it will go up the appeals ladder. This decision didn't address probably the thing that freaked out Netflix viewers the most. And obviously watching a Netflix documentary is not the same thing as doing what you did, which is watch the whole trial. But people watching the Netflix documentary saw things that weren't seen at trial, too. And watching the scene in which the court-appointed lawyer for Brendan Dassey, and as I recall it, this kind of investigator also who was working with the lawyer, basically begin this process, you know, this process that we ordinarily assume that law law enforcement will be engaged in, that police and prosecutors will be engaged in. But instead, really, it's the defense team that begins this process of breaking this young man down and persuading him either that he did it or the best thing that he could possibly do is say that he was involved. But this, the court decision doesn't really address that part, right?
It does. Basically, it says for legal reasons, Brendan Dassey didn't have a case on that particular account. So the federal habeas petition that was decided on Friday made two claims. One of them had to do with Brendan Dassey's lawyer. The judge ruled that for legal reasons, Dassey would not prevail on that argument. But, you know, the judge obviously ruled on the other part of the case, which is that the interrogations were unfair, unconstitutional, and that's why he granted in Dassey's favor.
Were you surprised watching the documentary, and I know you kind of live tweeted your own watching of the documentary, were you surprised later when you saw that scene when in fact the people who were nominally defending this guy seemed to be working, and not that that doesn't happen sometimes, but in the case of a guy who maybe has some impairments or maybe isn't able even to understand what's happening, that they were working so hard to get him in this direction as opposed to maybe seeking some kind of exoneration?
You're speaking now of Heaven's Own attorney.
Yeah, Kaczynski and the investigator, yeah.
Right. I think that was, it's fair to say, that the most surprising, particularly to attorneys or even just, you know, regular viewers of Making a Murder. You would anticipate that an attorney who's representing you or the investigator who's working for that attorney would be, you know, on your side, so to speak. And I think it's important to note that Len Kaczynski, that first lawyer, that was his point of view, was that he could get the best deal for Brendan Dassey, so to speak, if there were admissions and he could work out a plea bargain that would expose Dassey to a shorter time in prison. But, you know, again, it certainly was shocking to a lot of people to see the investigator for Dassey's own lawyer pressing him to confess.
First of all, a couple of more questions. One of them is, how much does this decision help the other defendant, Stephen Avery? Obviously, their trials were separate, but their fates are somewhat connected.
Yeah, there's no direct or immediate impact for Stephen Avery. You know, Brendan Dassey, you know, brought the case in federal court strictly based on, you know, whether his constitutional rights were violated. It didn't go to whether he was guilty or not guilty or the facts of the case. So there wouldn't be any direct impact on Avery. At the same time, you know, it's a 91-page decision issued only a couple days ago, and I think the lawyers for Dassey, for Avery, for the state, you know, will pore over it pretty closely, and whether there's a kernel or two in there that might affect Avery, you know, that remains to be seen.
Obviously, as you say, this is early on the heels anyway of the federal court decision. But I mean, one of the questions I'm sure a lot of people have, given the nature of this decision, and it's presuming that it proceeds through an appeals process with the same results, is, you know, that Brendan Dassey has some options that closely resemble those of his uncle prior to this whole murder case. His uncle was in the process of suing the county and a whole bunch of other people connected with an unlawful imprisonment. Brendan Dassey could conceivably do this if he could find a lawyer willing to engage in a pretty lengthy process. He could also maybe even sue the people who allegedly represented him the first time around. Is there even any whisper about something like that happening, or is it just too early?
Yeah, I would say too early. I think your question's a good one, though. I you know, a lot of people would, I think, draw that conclusion that, you know, they wonder if there would be that legal option for him. And I think because we're, you know, really just at the start of the process, we don't even know how it's going to shake out. You know, will the federal judge's decision be upheld or not? You know, we're sort of a long way down the road, potentially from that, unless the state would decide, you know, here in the coming weeks just to drop the case. But pretty early at this stage just to map out what might happen next.
All right, let's switch tracks for a second here, and I just want to ask you a few brief questions about what's been happening in Milwaukee for the last two nights. Obviously, this is all in reaction to the shooting of a suspect, an African-American suspect, who was, we are told, armed. But what's been happening in Milwaukee, it seems to be more than just one shooting. And obviously, it's very hard to, in any, you know, surefire way, know why people are rioting. But does this seem as though it's sort of the result of a lot of things building up? I know that in 2014, there was another shooting and the chief, Chief Flynn called for a Justice Department investigation. Are there all kinds of things boiling up into this moment in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I think Milwaukee, you know, shares the qualities of a lot of cities with big urban centers where there are pockets of poverty and more crime and, you know, other social problems and that have been in place for a number of years. And there certainly was unrest in that part of the city prior to this, but it sort of all came together. And Friday night, Saturday morning, there were actually 5 homicides, which is a huge number in a short period of time for Milwaukee. Then Saturday afternoon, police pull over a car that they said was looked suspicious, and 2 men who were in the car ran, and one of them was fatally shot by a police officer. Again, that was Saturday afternoon, and then by Saturday night, we had a lot of violence in the neighborhood where the fatal shooting occurred. 6 businesses set on fire, several police officers injured, and then some of that continued again Sunday night. So, definitely a tense time here and not something that we've seen before, at least not in many years.
Those of us who don't live in Wisconsin met this summer, just a few weeks ago, for the first time on television, Sheriff David Clark, who is the sheriff from Milwaukee County. He appeared at the Republican National Convention. He's African-American, but he had a lot of very tough talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. He came across as a guy who might not be the most soothing presence in a situation like this. He seems very opposed to the Black Lives Matter movement, which he called anarchy. What's his role been over the last 48 hours?
Well, the Sheriff's Department really has more of a peripheral role in terms of crime fighting and law enforcement. You know, these crimes occurred in the city of Milwaukee, and obviously there's a city of Milwaukee Police Department. The Sheriff's Department has played, a role in assisting, but it's by and large an operation of the Milwaukee Police Department.
So how are things today? Is there kind of a sense that the city's calming down?
There is, although, we had the same sense yesterday. Saturday night was very violent. Sunday during the day, calmed down. But, again, by Sunday night, there was more trouble. So how that will play out, again today and tonight, hard to say.
All right. Well, Tom Kircher, thank you very much for joining us today. Tom Kircher from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
All right. So we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the campaign. We always do that on Mondays anyway, it seems. We'll talk very specifically about friction between the Donald Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee. All right. Every Monday dawns with new news from the presidential campaign. There's usually too much of it, too much of it even for us to sanely discuss. We're going to break off one little piece of it here. Also, I'm going to open up the phones in the final segment of today's show. Joining us now, Kenneth P. Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico, who's been covering a very interesting part of this story based on some back and forth, I guess it's fair to say, between the Republican National Committee and the Donald Trump campaign. Welcome to our show.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
So let's start with what got said, and then maybe we can sort of backtrack to the circumstances under which it was said, which are also kind of interesting. But basically, the notion, and this is coming from Renz Priebus, who's the Republican National Chairman, or actually a spokesman for him in a rather unusual session. The notion was what? That if things don't change, that the Republican National Committee might redirect its resources come mid-October?
Yeah, that's right. Donald Trump has been relying to kind of an unprecedented extent on the Republican National Committee for the fundamental infrastructure of his campaign, the sort of basic political blocking and tackling that most candidates, by the time that they clinch a major party nomination, have built for themselves. We're talking about voter data, voter targeting, people on the ground in key swing states, advertising plans, advertising reservations. Trump did none of that. He did none of that through the primary, during which he relied on a much more sort of fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants, unconventional social media and, you know, charisma-powered campaign. And then once he pivoted to the general election, or sort of tried to pivot to the general election, he sort of threw in with the RNC and said, the RNC, you know, I didn't need to do any of that. This is your job. You do this for me. But as we found repeatedly throughout the course of the last several months since he's been the presumptive and then the official Republican Party nominee, relations haven't been that great with the RNC. It's not just that they kind of grit their teeth each time he says something incredibly impolitic and controversial that not only defies sort of political norms and accepted political etiquette, but also in some cases defies Republican Party orthodoxy. But beyond that, the RNC and the RNC staffers have found the campaign, Donald Trump's campaign, to the extent that it exists, very difficult to deal with. So they're getting a lot of pressure from Republican operatives and even candidates and campaigns to sort of bail, pull the plug on Donald Trump, stop spending money and committing resources to propping up his campaign, and to instead focus on these down-ballot races for Senate, for House, for governor that, are increasingly in jeopardy because of Donald Trump's unpopularity at the top of the ticket.
So I want to talk a little bit about the provenance of this information. It's a rather unusual thing. This was a representative of the Republican National Committee meeting with, I think, representatives of 14 different press operations, publications, whatever, 14 members of the media, I guess, in what was supposedly an off-the-record session, which is not a problem for you because Politico was not invited to this session in the first place, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, this is not an uncommon occurrence. You know, it's we see both with the Trump campaign and with the RNC an effort to sort of punish media outlets that they deem to be unfriendly to them. And, you know, in our case, we have worked very hard to cover the election right down the line. But, of course, Donald Trump has, made it easy to write a lot of things about his campaign and his past that, could be construed by the campaign and by its supporters to be negative stories. And as such, we've been blacklisted from getting credentialed for campaign events. And in this particular case, the RNC brought in a bunch of reporters to kind of lay out on, you know, off the record what they saw as their theory of the case as to how they have tried to help Donald Trump and what Donald Trump has done to sort of undermine their assistance. And we, as well as BuzzFeed, were not among the media outlets that were invited, so we set about reporting on what was said at this off-the-record gathering that we otherwise would have been barred from reporting on if we had accepted the invitation and accepted the terms of it being off the record. So reporters, by nature, are chatty folks, and we found some reporters who were willing to chat about what happened there that may be them violating the terms of the off-the-record agreement, but we didn't name them, so we felt comfortable in using this information in a way that we thought was very illustrative of what the RNC was thinking and is something different from what they would say on the record, and as such is even more valuable because it's more unvarnished and less spin than you typically get from a major political party engaged in knockdown, drag out presidential election.
Although cynical a soul that I am, I find myself wondering if I were Rince Priebus, the head of the RNC, if I were other officials within the Republican establishment, and I wanted to put this message out, A, to reassure Republicans and other people that, yes, we were working on this, we're doing anything we can. And one of the things I think that was reported was that Rince Priebus is on the phone to Trump 5 to 6 times a day, sometimes trying to get him back on track. If I wanted to get that message out and the message out that, you know, if necessary, we will cut this guy loose and take care of, you know, Rob Portman and Marco Rubio and Pat Toomey and Kelly Ayotte and whoever else down ticket is in trouble. And if I wanted also to try to see if I could do one more thing to get Trump's attention, since nothing else seems to work, you know, I mean, I'd have an off-the-record session with 14 reporters. I wouldn't invite Politico. I would assume that one or more of those reporters would then talk to Politico so that this thing would get out, but it would get out in a way in which I could then maybe sort of plausibly deny it afterwards, which is in fact what they've done. I mean, do you feel at all as though this is sort of part of their strategy to get this message out to a whole bunch of people so that nobody thinks that they're just letting Trump run wild like some rabid dog?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You don't even have to go through that sort of, you know, whisper down the lane type of scenario to see that as something that they were doing, you know, rather transparently, although opaquely transparently, since it was off the record. But, you know, what they wanted, and again, it's not uncommon for organizations, political organizations, campaigns, party committees, PACs to have sessions like this. And what they want is for that, you know, the sentiments that they express in these sessions to find their way into reporters' sort of presentation of the situation without their fingerprints on it. They want reporters, it's more powerful that for them if reporters write this story and just write flat out, you know, the Republican National Committee has done more to support Donald Trump's campaign than it did to support Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012 or John McCain's campaign in 2008. Kudos to the Republican Party for building this massive infrastructure, and shame on Donald Trump for botching this golden opportunity that they have presented. It's more, I mean, I'm sort of leaning into it, exaggerating the way it would be presented, but it would be more effective for the RNC if reporters were to sort of write that on their own. That is the goal of having an off-the-record session like this, is to do it in a way that it comes out, that their take comes out without their fingerprints on it. We just sort of, you know, cut out the middleman, or we found a middleman to cut out the sort of off-the-record, you know, a way in which that information is relayed and reported directly. And, you know, it may end up serving their purposes, as you suggested, but I don't think it looks good that they're gathering reporters to sort of shift the blame off the record to the Trump campaign while publicly saying they support the Trump campaign. You know, I think there's some discordance there, and yet another way in which this election cycle sort of looks like chaos for the National Republican Party and for Donald Trump's campaign.
We're talking to Kenneth P. Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico. So, you know, they put out this mid-October deadline, which, as you pointed out in your reporting, seems kind of late for a big redistribution of resources and energy, particularly because some states, critical states, have early voting, which starts soon, if not now. And I wonder if really what they're doing is something that's happening right now, which is that Priebus and the Republican leadership, they've got to differentiate their brand a little bit from Trump. I mean, one of their jobs, without appearing to completely abandon Trump or cut their losses with him yet, is to say in Ohio, Rob Portman is really different from Donald Trump. This guy's not that guy. Marco Rubio, I mean, as if it needed to be said, but Marco Rubio shouldn't be judged by the standards of Donald Trump, or Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, or Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, or pick your race. This guy isn't that guy, or this woman isn't that guy. These people aren't Trump. And we're not Trump. We have kind of a nominal relationship with Trump, but we want you to make different kinds of differentiations when you go to the polls in November. Is that, do you think, sort of part of what this message is?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have worked to sort of encourage this ticket splitting, you know, that instead, because there are states that Trump wouldn't win anyway. I mean, those states that you ticked off, they happen to be, you know, key swing states. But if you look at the polling, it's not very good for Trump in those key swing states. So sort of a recognition of that reality that even if Trump is somehow able to eke out a victory in Pennsylvania or Florida, you know, it's not, if it's a narrow victory, it's not foretold that, you know, Marco Rubio or Pat Toomey will ride the coattails and get the exact percentage. In fact, it's more likely that they could fare worse if it were packaged as a ticket. And so it's incumbent upon them, whether they like to admit it or not, to try to win some Clinton voters to support these Senate candidates. In fact, we see polling in Florida that suggests that Trump is hurting Marco Rubio there. And so it's a recognition of this uncomfortable reality where the party, despite the fact that they're publicly saying that they support Donald Trump and think that he can win, are preparing for a reality that's quite different from that.
Yeah, and it's hard to know without incredibly sophisticated polling how much of a problem Trump is in any of these races. I mean, Kelly Ayotte is way down in New Hampshire, but Trump is down even lower. And you start thinking, well, if you cut those, you know, those sandbags off, her balloon would definitely rise a little bit higher and maybe a lot higher. So last area to get into, this all seems to fit into an Uber narrative, which we might call the breaking point storyline. There's some sense at which, you know, Donald Trump, who constantly seems to be almost trolling the Republican establishment and the RNC with remarks about not needing a ground game, he's not running ads, he's not spending money on ads, he might not support various candidates, but then again, he might stop raising money for the RNC because he doesn't like the way they talk about him. So there's all of that going on, and then just this maybe just general gloom and doom sense on the other side that this guy's not going to win, and he may wreck our downturn ticket too. It feels as though the press now is looking at this breaking point storyline. It's almost, how would we know if that moment came where they just thought, you know what, we just need a lot of separation from this guy?
Yeah, I mean, whether we reach that point and we write the stories with that as the sort of background sentiment behind it or not, you just look at the polls. I mean, no candidate in Trump's position at this stage of the campaign has gone on to win the popular vote in the modern polling era. I mean, when we're talking about the modern polling era, we're talking about since 1952 with the advent of modern polling and TV, we haven't seen a candidate who has been this far behind after the convention in national polling as well as, you know, key sweeping state polling come back to win. So that's just reality, and he could buck that trend, although it doesn't appear as if he's doing anything to buck that trend. In fact, he appears to be pursuing the same, off-message, rhetoric and campaign, you know, lack of campaign infrastructure in these key swing states that has sort of got him to this point and has him on the negative trajectory. This is just a reality, and we can find different ways to write about it and parse it, and we can find different people to say different things about his chances, and we can look at all these other different metrics about ad spending and, you know, Hillary Clinton's advantage there or staffing and her advantage there. But the numbers are the numbers, and unless we see something significant, he is headed towards a loss and potentially a rather gaping loss in November.
All right, Kenneth Vogel, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
All right, Kenneth Vogel from Politico. When we come back, I don't do this very often. Some people would say I don't do it enough. I'm going to go to the phones. No guests, just you and me and the phones. 860, you have to actually call the phones. 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. I'm going to bring up some specific things when we come back, but if you have other worries and fears and things you need to get off your chest, and why wouldn't you, the way the campaign has gone this summer, give us a call. 860-275-7266. All right, we're back. I'm just laughing at the messages being sent around on our computer screens by the wonderful people who are putting this show together. On the board today, Betsy Kaplan. We got Kyahn Wolf back for, what, four days? 4 days of Kyahn Wolf. Now she's traveling in Ireland. We'll get her back for real at some point. Producer Jonathan McNichol is the person who put the show together today. Thanks to him. On the phones, we have a new intern. Her name is Kati Tillerst. I don't know how to say it. It's actually Katie Dolarski, who's like the senior executive. I don't even know what her new title is, but she's an extremely important, she's more important person here at this company than anybody else who's doing this show right now. And she's doing phones for us because we don't have any interns. We also have a Twitter account at WNPR Colin. We encourage you to look at that and to tweet at us. And we're on the Facebooks at the Colin McEnroe Show page. So go to the Colin McEnroe Show page on Facebooks and like that. I have other assignments to give you. But before I do that, I do want to say the phone lines are open. We'd love to hear what your anxieties are about the campaign. But let me plant some anxieties and see if they resonate with you. If not, I'll talk to you about your anxieties. I do feel as though over the last week or so, maybe even just 4 days or so, we've seen kind of a pivot. In some of the rhetoric of Donald Trump. And he's begun to talk more about how he might lose as opposed to the fact that he is going to win. I mean, he's not consistent about this, but he's talked about how and why he might lose this campaign. And I do feel as though he's laying a certain kind of groundwork. And the groundwork I think that he's laying has to do with, somewhat alarmingly, the legitimacy of the entire scenario that's unfolding. He's all along tried to suggest, in a way that I think is unusual. I mean, look, all campaigns try to vilify or demonize their opponents, but I think he's gone a little further to suggest that Hillary Clinton is not a legitimate opponent, that she really, you know, I mean, well, first of all, if you call her Crooked Hillary every time you mention her name, that's more like a schoolyard taunt than a piece of presidential campaign rhetoric. Still, I mean, he's in fact trying to suck out the legitimacy of her actual candidacy. And therefore, obviously, as president-elect, if she were to win, she would also seem to certain Trump supporters not legitimate. He's gone further to he's now started to talk about how the voting will be rigged. I mean, there's, you know, I think it's been suggested that statistically it's more likely that you get five Powerball numbers than that of a vote in an American presidential election be rigged. But he's really started to gin up fears of this, that the vote itself will not be legitimate. And then there's also this notion, I don't know how connected this is, but the media conspiracy to hurt him, which somehow raises questions about whether there should even be a free press or whether, in his words, you could even really call this a free press. There are all kinds of questions about the basic legitimacy of the system by which candidates are chosen, are elected, are covered by the press. And you do start to wonder what is going to happen if he does lose. Some people are afraid about what will happen if he wins. Now people are starting to talk a little bit more about what happens if he loses. And you know, is he temperamentally capable of making a concession speech that sounds anything like a concession speech? I mean, obviously, the most high-pressure concession speech of the last, 20, 30, 40 years was the one that Al Gore had to give in 2000 when he might have been somewhat unsure about whether he'd really lost or not. But he ultimately had to put the pin back in the grenade, had to put the United States on some kind of fairly level course and say, look, you have a president. His name is George W. Bush. It's not Al Gore. We really need to proceed now as a nation. I just, you know, I question whether this guy can do that. And if he doesn't do it, what happens? You know, and I've been sort of saying, well, best case scenario, what, 30, 40 million people basically don't believe the government is legitimate. Of course, I don't really know how many people don't believe the government is legitimate right now. Donald Trump, in his previous life as a private citizen, did everything in his power to suggest that at least certain things about the existing administration weren't legitimate. He, of course, is one of the people who really led the charge to suggest that that Barack Obama was not a native-born U.S. citizen and therefore really had no business being president at all. So he's no stranger to the argument that the president that we have shouldn't be the president. But it's going to be bigger, I think, and more alarming if he does it this time around. So I'd love your thoughts about this. You could maybe even just reassure me that I'm worried about nothing, that the republic is more resilient than I think it is, or you can join with me in twisting your fingers into a knot. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. I would quickly also say it might be interesting to talk a little bit about who could do anything about that. Like, so let's say that the scenario plays out as I've just sketched it. And by the way, I don't know that this is going to happen. I mean, all we ever have in a campaign is a snapshot of the current moment. And the snapshot of the current moment, it looks a lot like that. It looks like, A, Trump is going to lose. You just heard Ken Vogel say the same thing, that all we've got are numbers. The numbers tell us that he's pointing in the direction of losing. But, you know, campaigns are roller coasters. They're not straight lines. That could all change quite a bit after the first debate or after some other unforeseeable event. But, you know, let's just sort of say that things do go in a more or less straight line. Then it looks like, you know, yeah, he's going to lose. He's already setting the stage for a non-concession concession speech where he basically questions the legitimacy of the results. I do think one group of people who are going to have to step up are Republican leaders, starting with Reince Priebus, the Republican national chairman. But yeah, the McCains and the Ryans and the McConnells and whoever else you think commands any respect at all, probably, you know, all the members of the Bush family. A lot of people are going to have to come forward, and maybe they'll have to do like a telethon or something to solidify the understanding among the American people that, yeah, this was basically a fair election and, you know, one side lost, the other side won, and we're still a nation afterwards. But it could be, if he can't do it and he won't do it, that a lot of other people are going to have to do it for him. All right, I'm going to go to the phones right now. Here's Dottie in North Haven. Hi, Dottie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I just have a comment about Trump's adequacy or temperament to be the president of the United States, and I'm not going to reiterate all the examples of why he shouldn't, but to one point is that the way he comes out and just talks off the top of his head, whatever comes into his mind, and then takes 2 days to apologize for an inappropriate account of what he has to say, as opposed to the current president, President Obama. And if you think, if you see the way Obama speaks, you may think, oh my God, he's talking so slow, he's not saying what he really means, is because as president, he is constantly filtering and thinking of the appropriate way to position what he has to say in every answer as not to be taken in an inappropriate manner. And, you know, if he has a pause or he does not mention a name or he does not direct something against a country or a cause, it's very deliberate. And this is what a president has to do when he's, you know, the top of the biggest nation in the United States, in the world. So I don't think Trump can ever do that. And whatever comes out of his mind is really could be detrimental to our safety, to our position in the world, et cetera, everything that everybody said. I won't even go into the list.
Well, thank you for your call, Dottie. I would just sort of say also, I mean, it's kind of an overworked trope that the campaigns become predictors, particularly in the case of a pretty inexperienced politician, or in Trump's case, a non-experienced politician. Campaigns are represent attempts to predict how somebody would run something, how somebody would serve if they won the campaign. And in the case of Obama and Donald Trump, I think the other difference you see is, you know, Obama, one of the reasons he's pausing or going slowly is because he thinks all the time. He's a guy who really can see the moving parts of any situation very well. And he's been very well advised from 2008 when he was running for the first time and all through his presidency. But he's just a very good thinker in his own right and a very good parser of complicated situations. Trump isn't. I mean, Trump has various other gifts and as Ken Vogel said, charisma. But he's not necessarily a guy who can see all the moving parts of a campaign, and he doesn't seem to be able to act in his own behalf, which is why he keeps blurting out things that obscure possible detrimental news cycles to Hillary Clinton and get him in even more hot water. And so if you're going to use his campaign as a judgment as to how he would run the country, yeah, Dottie's right. He would blurt things out that could conceivably be very actionable and difficult for this country. But also, there's just a question about whether this guy really can kind of understand a complex situation. He doesn't seem to understand this one very well. Here's David in Long Island. Hi, David.
Hi, Colin. Colin, just like your opinion or just your thoughts about the remark Trump made at the end of last week about calling for voluntary poll watchers. And that kind of got me thinking that might be, he's worried about fraud, but that would be intimidating and could be a form of voter suppression. I'm thinking like a modern version of brown shirts, like guys might be wearing brown polo shirts, thugs outside and intimidating voters who want to vote in Pennsylvania and other maybe contested states.
Right. So it's a great question. And David, if you're interested in this or anybody else is, Phil Bump, who we have on the show a lot from The Washington Post, has a great piece about this this phenomenon. Because, yeah, Trump is not only calling for poll watchers and suggesting that there could be rampant election fraud on election day, which they're just, you know, once again, as I said before, there's just kind of no evidence that that's ever been a real problem. But he's not only calling for that, but he's sort of demanding that they try to get law enforcement involved in these situations. One thing that Bump does in his piece that's pretty interesting is, you know, there's some law, there's some precedent about this, about what you can and can't do under these situations. And troubles can arise if you appear to be targeting certain areas. For example, if you really want a lot of heavy volunteer or otherwise poll scrutiny on districts that are notably minority in composition or stuff like that, that can be an invitation to the Justice Department to come talk to you. So it's a two-way street. But yeah, I mean, once again, I think this is the laying of the groundwork, the laying of the argument that there's something wrong with this outcome. Now, if it gets blown out, which is also a possibility, but if it gets blown out by double digits, it's really hard at that point to say, well, they stole the election. And I will also say that Democrats have made similar arguments in 2004. There were arguments about allegations about the Diebold voting machines, especially in Ohio, and what the president of Diebold may or may not have said about what he saw as his job in that particular election. And of course, 2000 will always rankle people as a very disputed election result, and one that at least half the nation probably is never going to be entirely comfortable with. So, I mean, this thing slices both ways. But usually at the end of this process, whoever loses, whether it's John Kerry or Al Gore, you have to say something. You have to say, nope, that's it. It's over. This is the USA. You have a new president. It's not me. And the question I have is whether this guy could ever, ever do that. Here's Denise also. And I don't know which East Hampton you're in. Are you in East Hampton, Connecticut or East Hampton, Long Island?
East Hampton, Connecticut.
All right. Well, either East Hampton is fine with me. What's on your mind?
I've just been listening to Donald Trump's speeches. And I have to tell you, I'm a Hillary person. So I'm going to put my bias out there. But when he starts to rant on, I've noticed that before he tells his biggest lie, he says honestly, or some variation of, you know, this is the truth, or honestly, folks, and stuff. And then he proceeds to repeat himself several times. And I think that that's the time when he shows the, you know, is telling the biggest story. It's kind of like a big storyteller. And I wonder if that's something that you've noticed.
I have a different theory about Trump's speech cadence. And first of all, I want to say we have a limited amount of time left. It would be great to get a Trump supporter on the air or somebody who went to the Fairfield rally at Sacred Heart University. That would be so great. And the number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear from both sides here if we possibly can. I was going to write an article about this. I still may. This is the first time I've ever said this out loud to anybody, really, is... I have developed this theory over the last few days, and I know that what I'm going to say is going to sound like a crackpot theory, but that a lot of what Donald Trump does and what he says and the way that he says it, and I'm only mentioning this because she just brought up this whole thing about preceding sentences with the word honestly. My theory is that he's very, very heavily influenced by Don Rickles. And specifically the album Hello Dummy, which would have come out, I think he would have been 20 when that album came out. His actual cadence, and I started to think about it with the Second Amendment voters line, because it's exactly the rhythm that Don Rickles would use. Now, Don Rickles obviously was a famous insult comic who, in fact, trafficked in a lot of the kinds of negative imageries about minorities that Donald Trump also traffics in. So, but that's not what I'm saying right now, although we could break that off and say that also could be a Rosetta Stone for looking at the Donald Trump campaign. But I actually mean the rhythm of what he says and the way he punctuates things orally. When he's talking, he says things in a rhythm that I happen to believe. I'm going to write a piece about this that is very heavily influenced by Don Rickles. You heard it here first. All right. So, well, where should I go now? We've got a lot of calls coming in. I apologize to anybody we don't get to. Ooh, that's kind of a noisy line there, John. I might actually, since I can pick and choose, I'll go to Dave in West Hartford. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, take me, please.
Okay.
I think they ought to change the name of the party that Trump's running for to the Trump Party, because he's really embraced by the people that the Republican Party has been trying to attract for the last 20 or so years.
Well, yeah,
we'll catch on.
Well, I think there's a group of people that maybe they would have liked to have had who were less likely voters. Claire Malone of 538 recently reported on an internal memo where they were basically talking about how part of Trump's strategy, this is an internal Trump campaign memo, talking about part of his strategy is to get the kind of people who don't vote in elections typically. The problem is that there are an awful lot of Republicans who do vote in elections who don't see things that way. The kinds of candidates they've gotten behind, for the most part, have not engaged in that kind of rhetoric. Sure, you can find some examples of maybe where that's happened. But, you know, you think about a party that ran people like John McCain and Mitt Romney, you know, that's sort of not, this is not who the party has been. And I don't think it's who the party really wants to be. I think the expense, the Faustian bargain of getting those other voters is probably not worth it to the Republican establishment. All right, we have to stop here. I wish we could take more calls. Look at all those people calling in. I'm so sorry. We'll do open phones again really soon. The fog's broken. It ain't easy, baby.